Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and all I hear in the chat room, Larry, is crickets. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 266 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Make sure that you find all the things on the show notes and not the show notes. Find us over on YouTube. Click like and subscribe. Download the show on your podcast app and give all the reviews and do all those great things. You know what I'm saying? You know this rule, Larry.
I have heard tell of this, yes.
I got a question for you. There was a conviction in court. Is it in civil court? Is it still found guilty? I guess you're still found guilty in civil court.
You're found liable, but yes, go ahead.
Ah, okay. So here's my question. So Trump went to court, or I guess the jury announced that they found him guilty of inappropriate things with this woman, and I'm not trying to go into that part of it, but because of who he is. And I was wondering this question. If it is a civil regulatory scheme, Larry, this is a civil regulatory scheme, this registry thing, right?
That's what they say.
And so if it's a civil regulatory scheme and you are found guilty in civil court of doing inappropriate things, and he wasn't found guilty on this part, but just go with me, then wouldn't he end up on the civil regulatory scheme?
I have heard of a state or two that has been requested in legislation to make a person who had been found civilly liable to register. I don't believe any state has added that to the enumerated conditions that will trigger registration, but it has been thought of before. And remember, the burden of proof is so much lower in a civil case. It's only by a preponderance of evidence versus beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case.
And preponderance, is that's the 50 plus one?
Slightly more than 50%. Whatever it takes to move the conscience of the fact finder to conclude that it was more likely than not.
I see. Interesting. So, but do you see the quandary there, though, that if you're found guilty in civil court, you would end up on the civil regulatory scheme? Or, I guess, worded otherwise, if it is a civil regulatory scheme, why does it take criminal court to put you on the civil regulatory scheme?
A great question, but let's don't talk about that too loud, because since it's already been proposed out there, I could see that there'd be an advocacy that would spring up and say, well, let's take them into civil court and get them found liable, kind of like after the O.J. Simpson, when he was found not guilty in the criminal court. Then he was tried in civil court and he was found liable for the death of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. And that's a much lower standard. So if you could put him on a registry for that with that much lower showing of culpability, that would start us down a path where there would be really no need for a criminal court. You would just bring everyone to a civil inquiry and find them with a lesser standard of evidence and say, what, you have to register and we get to punish you for the rest of your life for something we couldn't convict you of doing.
That sounds horrible. God. It's still bad enough, though, that you're found guilty with the higher standard and you're punished for the rest of your life, except for it's not punishment. It's a civil regulatory scheme, right?
Right. But we have to show that it's punishment. We have to stop with our summary judgment. And you sent me a plethora of pleadings from a state that I will not name tonight for fear of provoking a backlash. But I read through a significant amount of that, and that's exactly what they are doing.
I see. All right. Well, please, sir, give me a rundown for the show this evening, if you wouldn't mind.
We've got a couple of questions that have been submitted. They shouldn't take too long. And then we're going to get into this crazy case that you seem to be obsessed over that came out of Albuquerque about a police officer here. And then we're going to get into a deeper dive on the plea process, and the two tie together, the case and the plea bargaining process, which I don't think you're much of a fan of.
It seems like there's a penalty for taking a plea deal as opposed to, for taking something to court instead of to trial instead of taking a plea deal. It seems like that way.
Well, there is.
Should there be?
I don't know. That's why it's called a plea bargain. Because in theory, both sides win.
Nobody gets everything they want, but nobody walks away totally happy either.
That's the reason why it's referred to as a bargain. But as we will illuminate this evening, the process has been distorted over the decades, and it's really not what it should be. But yes, we're going to get into it with this discussion. And I'm surprised that you even know about this case up in Pennsylvania.
Well, you'd be surprised what I know about. All right. Well, let's move on. We'll have the first question here. It says, love the podcast and always look forward to new episodes. I live in Iowa. I prefer to remain anonymous on the podcast if you use my question. Okay, John, I don't know your name, though. I'm just picking on you. I own my own home with 3 bedrooms, and it's in a location in the county that is perfect for those with the 2,000-foot law restriction. I don't have that myself. I have one roommate who is a PFR and has the restriction. I still have a bedroom remaining. I'd like to put another PFR in there as well with the same restriction, but the parole officer won't put more than 2 of us PFRs together. What is the proper way to fight this kind of battle to let more than 2 live together so I can help people from going homeless? Thanks for your time and effort and all you do. Great question.
It is, and I'm going to make some assumptions here, like I typically do with questions, when he says the parole officer will not allow. The inference is that both of the people are on supervision of some sort, probably parole, since he said the parole officer. Well, if you have a condition of supervision, it would probably be not wise or very unwise to try to challenge that. If it's in Iowa's PFR registration scheme, that's a whole different matter. If there's some states that have laws that people that are on the registry can't live together. They refer to that as clustering, you see.
Right.
But so we're going to assume that this is a condition of supervision. And since when you're on supervision, particularly parole, and that word is key because parole is theoretically a test drive release, early release from prison. So far, so good, right?
I'm with you.
You've gotten out of prison early. And when you're leaving the walls of prison early, they have extraordinary powers over you in terms of what they can limit you and your activities and your associations. Having said that, I would probably not try to rock the boat. What you're going to end up having happen if the person who is attempting to join the other person is living there and you start rocking the boat, you may end up with the first person not being allowed to live there, because I can see the supervising authorities say this is a troublemaker. And therefore, our client is not best served by living with a troublemaker who's trying to rock the boat. Now, if it's something in Iowa law specific, then I'd have to take a look at that part of the statute and figure out what the best strategy would be. But I think I would leave this one alone.
Yeah, I can see why. A friend of mine does this in the Augusta area, and I don't know who he has rented now, but in the past he has had 2 PFR roommates, along with him being a PFR.
Oh, I commend what he's doing. I agree with it, because he's trying to provide an opportunity where a person has limited options that's subject to that 2,000-foot requirement and stipulation. If you look around the urban settings, it really puts a lot of restriction barriers. 2,000, it's almost a half a mile, right? It's 5,280 feet is a mile. Correct. So you're approaching a half a mile of distance, and that puts a lot of things off limits.
Absolutely. All right, well then let's move over to the next question. And this is, I'm writing about an inmate that was sentenced per Cali. I'm assuming that's California.
Correct.
Kelly Penal Code 288ALL. The allegations of this inmate claim he is part of the LGBTQ plus community and at one point took photos of an underage boy. There was never any human contact, just photos. Regardless of the allegations, the inmate was sentenced to 2 years for every photo which he had, 9 in total. He is on his 10th year of the 18 he was sentenced for. Per Cali Penal Code 667.5, this crime is considered violent. I feel that this is not right and should be separated in a more ethical manner. Due to the changes that have been happening, he is willing to use this case in an attempt to change the law in a more meaningful manner. I'm hoping to get some feedback on your thoughts. Do you feel this constitutes violence, or am I on the right track? I feel there should be a better way of handling the law.
I'll take the first question. Do you feel this is constitutes violence? Based on what he said, I see very little violence since taking photos. But the citizens of California have found it to be very objectionable. And they have made a law that says that doing this is so objectionable that we will treat each photo as an individual and separate count. And therefore, he's in a conundrum here because it is the law. And what can he do about it? Well, what he could do is he could allege that it's cruel and unusual punishment. We just had an episode about that, didn't we?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, well, cruel and unusual punishment is an almost impossible standard to meet because putting people in a chamber filled with gas or strapping them to a chair and putting electrodes on their body and juicing them up in the most painful way that can be imagined is not considered cruel and unusual punishment by the U.S. Supreme Court. Therefore, it's hard to imagine that an 18-year prison sentence where you stay alive would be deemed cruel and unusual punishment. So if I were going to look at a legal challenge, I would try to look at a challenge where a person has more time imposed on the 18 years, right? 18 years is a long time, but it's not shocking in terms of how much time is imposed for people for these type of offenses. They can be 60, 70, 80, 100 years, effectively a lifetime sentence.
Right.
And therefore, this is not the best candidate to raise that challenge. But the other option is to get the law changed where you would cap the amount of counts that could be stacked. So each one would be an individual up until a certain amount. And I think we did that here in my state. I think there's not precise language, but there's guidance in terms of how many years they can get for certain levels of porn possession. And I think it maxes out around 10 or 11 years, which is better than 18. So he's got a legislative approach and a legal challenge, but this guy's not the best candidate for a legal challenge.
These laws were written when the best you could really come up with was like a Polaroid. I'm assuming that that's how this kind of comes about, where the cost of having a photo was significantly higher than it is now, where you can snap 100 pictures in 10 seconds on your phone.
Probably the statute could be old, but it's the objection of the community. It's the community sensitivity. The citizens of California are not too happy of having their teen boys' photos taken, revealing their private parts to older adults. And they're expressing that outrage through a statutory scheme that says punish these people severely. That's their prerogative to do that.
Let me throw this at you to get a little bit nerdy for a second. When you take a photo with your camera, at least on like modern phones, it'll take 2, 3, 5, even 10 pictures to analyze which one's the best and possibly merge them so that it takes them underexposed and overexposed and then blends to give you like the super dark darks and the vibrant colors at different exposures. Well, now your phone could be holding on to 10 pictures for every picture you have. And if some forensics person wanted to get really, really picky, they could then, you've taken one photo, but you have dozens.
Based on a significant amount of time in many states, and therefore like I say, this guy with 18 years, although I feel it's excessive, it's not a good candidate for a challenge under any provision of the Constitution that I can think of.
Yeah, I agree. I understand.
I can't see the Supreme Court of California or of the United States, either one, saying that this is cruel and excessive and unusual punishment.
Well, would you do me a favor and would you go the other direction and could you like construct in Larry's perfect land what case you would want to challenge this way? Have you ever thought about that?
Someone who has a very long sentence that effectively is a lifetime sentence, and that person hopefully is a first-time offender, and they got a life sentence for something, and hopefully the pictures they snapped were of a person who was not too much below the age. The public is less incensed and enraged if the person was 17 years old versus if they were 12 years old.
We were talking years ago about the kid who who took pictures of his junk, sent it to his girlfriend who was underage, and he got tried for having it being distribution and possession of, and it was pictures of himself because he was a minor. It was just so bizarre. But maybe that would be a kind of case?
Well, something like that. That was from Maryland, I believe. The pure.
I thought it was North Carolina. There was another one we talked about from North Carolina, I thought, but whatever. It doesn't matter. That's just ridiculous that you have pictures of yourself and you're a minor. And then it's like, I don't understand. That one really made my head twist around in circles.
Well, the problem is during the drafting process, we were not there. And we did not tell them that, now, wait a minute, the way this is constructed, a prosecutor can charge the minor. And if we're not intending to have minors being charged for sending pictures of their junk, we've got to say that because the court cannot, remember all the episodes we've done, they can't write into the statute what the legislature has deliberately left out. If you want that exemption, you better say it, because otherwise it's legislating from the bench and we cannot have that.
That sounds bad. I've heard that people get pissed off about this.
Well, they do until it's to their benefit. And then amazingly, they're okay with legislating from the bench if they can't win it any other way. We're all like that. You and I both are the same way.
Of course.
But I would look at this from a legislative point of view. He's got to find a sympathetic lawmaker that has no threat of losing their election. And doesn't matter what side of the aisle, preferably it's on the Republican side, but they're kind of scarce in California. But you've got to find someone who is safely in their seat, and you've got to show them the absurdity of this and that the California prison system is filled with people that are serving exceptionally long sentences for first-time offenses because merely the number of images. And that's not good for us because our prisons are costing us too much money already. You win the liberals over because they see more funds they can do things with. They'd rather spend those dollars on other than prisons. And you can win the conservatives over because theoretically they're trying to be so frugal with the resources, and you can save money. And if the conservatives maintain any intellectual honesty, they would be okay with that if you find the right conservative to lead the charge.
Very well. Shall we move along, sir?
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
I got a bone to pick with you.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, you think I don't pay attention to the news, but... I saw that there was a police officer that was arrested in Albuquerque, which I believe is kind of in your neck of the woods. He allegedly tried to coerce a 13-year-old into a relationship. Do you feel up to talking about this situation unfolding in the Duke City?
I do. I'm familiar with it, but I don't know how it would be up there in California, not California, but in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and all across the Northeast and Georgia and everywhere else where I've been hearing people. This has been brought to my attention by multiple people.
Is that right? It's a pretty high profile case, and I'm guessing it will probably go to trial, and then there would be a trial penalty if he chooses to do so. Is that the reason why we're going to talk about it tonight?
Yes, this is definitely why we're going to talk about it, because it fits in with the trial penalty plea bargaining process. So it is definitely why it's in here. That's why I said go ahead and put it in, even though I didn't think anybody cared about it, but my phone's ringing off the hook.
All right. Well, to set it up, a former police officer, former now because he's no longer a police officer after this, Joshua D., who is 27 years old, has been accused of trying to strike up a romantic relationship with a 13-year-old girl in March. It is alleged that he invited her to sleep over. Also, it is alleged that he tried to kiss her. How did they meet?
They met after the officer initially responded to her house when she was contemplating suicide on two separate occasions.
That is pretty crazy, Larry. What has he been charged with?
Well, he's been charged with child solicitation by electronic communications device and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And he's also charged with receiving public money for services not rendered after meeting the girl at her apartment on multiple occasions while in uniform and on duty.
Can you say that part again, please?
You've never heard of this charge before, neither have I. I had to look it up to see if it existed. He's charged with receiving public money for services not rendered, and he was on duty, allegedly, and he met the girl on duty and in uniform, so therefore he was stealing from the citizens of Albuquerque.
I have seen videos like on, you know, like whatever, cop drama or whatever, where a cop spends a little on-duty time in maybe his girlfriend's house, whatever, something like that, and they get in trouble for I guess, essentially stealing, right?
Well, I mean, it is, but you have to admit that charge is funny, right?
It's not funny. It's never funny, Larry. Nothing you offer is ever funny. Let me give you a little bit more background. On March 9th, police learned the teen reported Officer D as being inappropriate with her. The girl told police she was scared as Officer D had become aggressive when she wouldn't kiss him. Police said Officer D first met the girl on February 8th when he responded to her residence after she threatened suicide due to bullying at school. Then on February 14th, he responded to the girl's home again when she threatened suicide with a knife. I'm guessing that the department policy required the officer to cooperate with their investigation?
That is correct. And the former officer reportedly told investigators he thought the girl was 14, but he had developed a crush on the teen.
Well, can you tell me the significance of being 14 versus 13 under New Mexico law?
There's no discernible difference whatsoever, and I was chuckling about that. And of course, that's not funny either to you, but if you were to spend the whole day in any public forum around in any state of the country and you ask them, if a 27-year-old is trying to hook up with a 13-year-old and he thought that she was 14, what difference would that make? I don't think you'd find a single adult that would say it makes any difference. But he apparently felt it was important that being 14 rather than 13.
So I bet you if you were in Mississippi or Alabama, everybody would be like, yeah, makes a bell the difference in the world.
So that's another funny as far as I'm concerned.
Again, not funny. What did the police find when they searched the former officer's vehicle?
Well, at that time, he was still an officer. They found an unopened package of condoms, and this was according to court records. When they searched his Snapchat chat account, they found an inappropriate chat with a separate self-proclaimed 13-year-old girl.
This is going south really fast, Larry. The article stated that prosecutors have filed a motion to detain him until trial, calling him a danger to young female children in our community who has shown that he has a sexual interest in vulnerable girls. In the motion, prosecutors said the Snapchat messages were between Officer D and a separate teen are still being reviewed. The prosecution stated, however, this indicates that DL, the minor in this case, may not be his only victim. So that... Well, and then according to the story, to go further, the girl was taken to a hospital and treated for the next several days after the incident. Then Officer D began texting her on February 25th, asking if she was doing okay. Police said the pair began talking over the next few weeks, with the former officer at first offering to cruise by to check on her, offering to bring snacks and candy. He then offered to take her on a ride along and would buy you anything you want. Albuquerque police police policy certainly would not have permitted this kind of contact. That's got to be true, right?
You're correct. But it got worse. On March 3rd, Officer D visited the teen at her apartment for the first time, texting her that she was very cute and adorable. Afterward, according to the complaint, that was done. Then on March 5th, he texted that they go to a movie together, and this might be bad, but I think I like you. He was definitely escalating.
Police then said the teen texted that she was inexperienced being in a relationship, and he replied, "I can teach you, and we can keep it a secret. I don't think people would be okay with us dating," he texted the teen, according to the complaint, "because you're much younger and I'm much older, LOL." Police said the teen asked, "Is that bad?" And Officer D replied, "Technically, yes, LOL again." He then reportedly told the girl she should come stay the night sometime. This certainly sounds like solicitation to me.
Well, not so fast. Asking someone to spend the night does not necessarily imply sex is on the agenda. I mean, is it possible to have someone sleep and not have sex with them?
That's a stretch there. There you go again, making excuses for criminal conduct. When the teen asked what they would do, Officer D replied, "Well, we can see how the night goes and just take it from there." Can you make an excuse for that, though?
Well, I can only work with the evidence that we have right now. And he said we could watch movies, play games, kiss, whatever else the night brings. Kissing is not sex.
Oh, you want me to play the clip from Bill Clinton about what sex is, don't you?
Not really, but I'm just saying that in a legal sense, you guys are making assumptions that kissing is sex. And under the way I read the statute, I don't believe that it would constitute sex. So therefore, if he said, "I would like to kiss you," that is not the same thing as saying, "I would like to have sex with you." Those are two different activities.
The allegations are that Officer D deleted the messages between the two on his phone, but records showed they texted each other 250 times in 2 weeks. Also, police said surveillance video in the teen's apartment caught Officer D meeting with the girl after midnight on March 9th, while on duty and in uniform. The video reportedly shows him hugging the teen before they move out of view, and he allegedly tried to kiss her. Explain that one.
Well, again, kissing is not sex. I'll add a little bit of ad lib here. You would think that after 33,000 missing emails and all the hoopla about that, and you would think after $787 million have been paid out or in the process of being paid out for text messages and emails, you would think that people would be very careful about what they put in text messages and emails. But anyway, the teen told police she covered her face with a folder to stop him from kissing her, and he got frustrated. But he got frustrated is her opinion.
He texted her, "That was mean." And she replied, "How was it rude?" And he texted, "Because I was hoping for a yes." Larry, you're short on spin, so try to spin your way out of it.
Well, I can easily argue that he was hoping for a yes to the kissing since they were in a public place. But again, kissing is not sex. It would lead to sex, but it isn't.
The police said the teen told him that Officer D should have been there to protect her. That is a very enlightened response from a 13-year-old.
Well, it's an enlightened response, or maybe it's someone who's been coached.
When the police interviewed Officer D, he initially told them he was doing a welfare check on the girl and denied trying to kiss her. He said he invited the girl to stay over to give her options where she would have a sense of peace. Is that a viable defense?
It's going to be tough because the police said he acknowledged it was not appropriate and then told police, he had developed a crush on the team and felt they were more than friends. His own words are going to be bad. Remember, don't talk to the police. Well, he was the police, but he talked to the police. And he asked her for photos and sent her photos, including of one of him in his bed. But in the public domain, that picture of him in his bed was not in of itself a crime. It did not say he was exposing his junk. But this is going to be a tough case to defend. Absolutely. And that's why we're going to dig into this about what the strategy would be a little bit later. He has definitely dug himself into a hole.
Can we dig into that strategy a bit, if you don't mind?
Sure. That's going to be exciting because I'm hoping to be a part of his defense team. I'm actually volunteering my services pro bono.
So how did the pretrial detention motion go?
It's still being decided. He's being held in detention right now. He'll be back in court on May 18th. And the court at that time will determine if the state has met its high burden of proof. And the burden is that no set of conditions can be fashioned that will ensure his appearance and protect the community. This is a part of our fabulous constitutional amendment that the voters adopted some 5 years ago or 6 years ago that eliminated cash bail. And the trade-off to win this constitutional amendment was that we were going to empower our judges to hold people without bond. Theoretically, it was going to be in very extraordinarily rare cases. It's become far too common. And this is an example of its overuse. There's no reason for this man to be held pretrial. There just isn't.
Do you think that they will prevail?
Being that it's high profile and being sensationalized and made its way around the country, apparently, I think it's going to be tough for a trial judge to grant him release. But the man, let's look at it. He has no criminal history, or he wouldn't be on the police force. At the most, he could have used a little pot in his lifetime. He possibly had a DWI. I think that they can get past if they've had a number of years elapsed since the DWI, but I don't know that for certain. But he has no criminal history. I'm assuming that a person with no criminal history, with fourth-degree felony charges, if we looked at fourth-degree felony charges, which is the most minimal charges we have on the felony side, most of them are released to the community. There's no reason to hold this man. They can fashion conditions of relief, including electronic monitoring, including exclusion zones. They can do all those things, and he needs to be out of jail. He's a target for all sorts of abuse. He's locked down 24 hours a day. This is atrocious.
I will say that you're sounding a whole lot like a bleeding heart liberal. Why should he get preferential treatment?
There's no bleeding heart here. I simply believe in our Constitution, and that document guarantees a right to bail and the presumption of innocence. I'd say the same thing regardless of who the accused happens to be. Former President Trump deserves no less, and an accused police officer deserves no less as well. I only wish that someday it will come to be that the police can bring themselves to say the same thing when they accuse someone of committing a crime, because I say it without any hesitation.
And I'm going to assume that he can't get a fair trial in Albuquerque. Do you agree?
Well, prior to my stint on grand jury, I would have said, yes, he can get a fair trial. At this point, I'm not as confident that he can get a fair trial. But I'm hoping he can get a fair trial because I'm assuming they're not going to offer me any type of plea. But let's keep going. But man,
sure.
I would have said a fair trial was possible because I used to think our community was more enlightened, but I saw it from a different perspective. When it came to sex cases, there was no interest whatsoever in fairness.
All right. Well, then if we go for worst case scenario, if he's convicted on all charges and they throw every book at him, how much time does he face?
6 years.
Only six?
Correct.
Do you think the prosecution will offer some kind of plea deal?
It's going to be very difficult because, like I said, there's so much been said about it. And the community is rightfully outraged. You know, we pay these people decent money to be on the force, and they're supposed to serve and protect. And clearly, if the allegations are true, he made some bad choices. But again, I don't think we need to throw him in jail.
Let's assume that you've been retained by the defense to help. What is your strategy there?
Well, my strategy is to keep this man from being sentenced to any jail or prison time. It would be very tough on him being a former law officer. You combine that with the age of the person who's making the accusations, and it's not going to go well for him in prison. So therefore, he's in protective custody for the entire time. And I don't even know if they can keep him safe, even in protective custody. I've not been in the big house before, and I don't know what they would do with someone like this. When you were in the big house, did they have any former police officers serving time?
I don't recall running into anybody of that sort. Not you know, but I wasn't Mr. Socialite and going around and trying to politic and shake hands and kiss babies and whatnot. So if you force the state to go to trial and roll the dice, haven't you heard that if everyone did that, then the whole system would crash?
I've heard that strategy, and it's doomed from the beginning. On the defense side, our job is to defend and get the best outcome for our clients. If I were working for Officer D's attorney, we would both be on the same page on that. Our job is not to crush the system. Rather, we are to work for the best interest of Officer D and each individual client. And the interest I clearly articulated is to keep Officer D from going to jail. Our interest and job is not to crash the system.
So in your first move, if you were to attain this position, would you move to suppress the statements that he's made?
Probably would not. I don't think an attorney would want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that. I would certainly need to review the discovery very carefully before I could say for certain. But he's a police officer. He's been trained as an investigator at some level. And trying to say that he did not know his rights is going to be a long shot. And remember, you do not want to make the prosecution work. Because A, that's not good. And B, each time they win, you have less leverage. The uncertainty that you might win is part of your leverage. So my strategy would be look at the case and look for weaknesses that might encourage them to offer a plea that does not include prison time. If that's not agreeable, we would ask the state, at least, can you agree to not seek prison time and leave it up to the court? And they're probably not even going to agree to that. But if they won't agree to a stipulation of no prison time at initial sentencing, then we would ask them to agree to not make a recommendation on sentencing at all. And that would be an achievement in of itself.
Why wouldn't you try to get his statements tossed? It seems like those would be some of the more incriminating kinds of things. So why wouldn't you try to get those removed?
Well, we're going to lose. So you've got to draft a motion. You've got to file it. The prosecution's going to have to draft a response. And then you've lost that motion. And the possible leverage you have, you always tell the prosecution, I've got motions that I can file. Each time you file and lose one, you've just taken away some of your leverage. I think the prosecution's going to know a motion like that's not going to prevail because the man is a police officer. He knows not to talk to the police. So I think you're getting nowhere with that. He's a highly educated man. I think he have to have at least a couple years of college to be on the police department. He can't claim he didn't understand English. He can't claim all these things that a suspect can claim. He knew better.
Let's assume that the prosecution says no to any negotiations, and then what happens? What's the strategy that you guys would go after then?
Well, we'd prepare the case for trial. We'd try to shoot them down on their theory that the former officer was seeking sex. That, of course, will be very difficult because the average juror is not going to be amenable to any argument that a 27-year-old man was not seeking sex. I'd also try to sink them on the theft of service charge. And if we get a not guilty on that charge, we've reduced their maximum by 18 months. Each one of these fourth-degree felonies carries 18 months. So you combine 18, 18, 18 on three charges. And then you've got one additional thing on the child solicitation. If you show up for a meeting, that elevates that one level. And they have not alleged that he showed up for a meeting yet, but that would logically be their next move because that would give them additional exposure. So that's why I said maximum he's facing. You take 18 for the three felonies, for the two felonies, and then you do the enhancement 3 years. So you're looking at a total of 6 years potential exposure. But if we can get them, if we can get the theft of service charge, gone, then we've taken 18 months of exposure off the table. I think that's a tough sell. He was on duty, yes. But what I'm going to do on the defense team is I'm going to come in and say, well, okay, guys, you're saying he stole service. How many, in the interest of the community, it's standard operating procedure that Albuquerque police follow up with people who have been victimized by crime, who are suffering any type of adverse, and that I would say suicide, almost committing suicide, is certainly an adverse situation in your life. So we're going to tell our officers that they can't do any community relations as a result of that. Let's be consistent here. You've never brought this charge against anybody before. This is selective prosecution. I would be willing to file that motion that this is selective prosecution. And I bet I could. They would have a difficulty showing that they've brought this charge against anybody before. We knocked that one out. We just taken 18 months off of them, off of his exposure.
Wouldn't these then, couldn't these be run concurrent instead of consecutive?
It could be, but if he goes to trial, they're not going to.
Of course, there's the trial penalty piece. Of the three charges, which do you think is the strongest in your opinion?
The contributing delinquency of the minor is probably the strongest charge. Depending on the evidence, they might have, it might not be such a strong case on the child solicitation, but the contributing delinquency of a minor, I don't think you can spin that any way. You show up at after midnight at a teenager's house. Most parents are not going to be in approval of their teen having a late night rendezvous with an older adult that's twice their teen's age. So I suspect that that one's going to be tough to get a not guilty verdict on. You're not going to get a directed verdict at the end of the trial by the judge saying the evidence isn't there. You're not going to get a not guilty on that one. So you've got that one. But remember, that's not a registrable PFR offense. That is not a registrable offense. We're not one of those states where you can say, well, sex was the underlying motivator for that commission of that crime. So you have to register for contributing delinquency of a minor. If that's all that they convict him on, then he's not a registered PFR.
And then everybody is looking at the text messages, will believe that he wanted sex. How do you win on that one?
Well, it's not what everyone knows that matters. It's what they can prove that matters. I've seen no evidence so far that he explicitly asked for sex. It was implied, but not specifically requested. And at least with the evidence that's out in the public domain, now, magically, I'm going to become a textualist here. I'm going to look at that statute. I'm going to say, where's the solicitation for sex? Where did the officer ask for sex? He said, whatever happened. He didn't say, I want to have sex with you. And I'm going to say, he didn't specifically ask for sex. And then they're going to say, well, what about the condoms? I'm going to say, can you pinpoint the purchase date of those condoms that he had with him? I would say the average 27-year-old man is running around with condoms. And put it into context, the police department assigns a patrol unit to the officer. They get to take it home with them. It becomes their personal vehicle. It's supposedly a deterrent for crime in the community. That officer uses that as his personal vehicle. I would dare say that he might go out on a date driving that patrol vehicle, possibly. And who knows? But unless you can show me that he bought condoms and he told this 13-year-old that he was bringing condoms for sex, you have not proven that he was intending to use those condoms for sex with her.
I can tell you that if we rolled the clock back to, 2004-ish, I sat on a jury trial for, it was a police officer that had been alleged to have taken photos and then used those photos to extort, an informant to give up information. And everyone on the jury, I think I was the jury foreman for this, everyone on the jury thought that he was guilty, but like, show me the Polaroid. And there was no Polaroid. So like, while we believed he did it, we didn't have the evidence to support that he did it. So we found him not guilty.
Well, being that I'm not expecting a plea offer in this case, if I'm invited to participate, I would definitely roll the dice, because that's the hand we're being dealt. But I would hammer the fact that there was no direct request for sex. You're going to make the man a sex offender, and he was acting inappropriately and goofy and irresponsibly. But that is does not constitute a direct solicitation for sex. And your duty, as the great attorney said in the O.J. Simpson case, the evidence doesn't fit here. This man was totally inappropriate, but he didn't specifically ask for sex unless other evidence comes out that I'm not aware of.
Let's say he does get convicted, then what happens?
Oh, well, then we have to prepare for sentencing, and we humanize this man in every way possible. We have a psychosexual evaluation done. We have to at that point. If he gets convicted of the child solicitation, he's a convicted sexual offender. So we have to have a sexual evaluation done. And in fact, we would have a full psychological evaluation. And we would want to know all about anything that would provide the court with a way to mitigate the sentencing. We would look for delayed development. Maybe he was in special education. We would look at everything, trying to figure out how to minimize the anger, because the judge is theoretically a neutral and detached individual. And at that point, we're arguing directly to the sentencing judge that this man has been convicted. And we would bring in everything that we possibly can that shows he's a good person. And maybe he's emotionally immature. We would look at that as his 27 years of age. He may have an immaturity that goes along that doesn't make him act his age. And we'd want to show his full life and ask for letters of support from his friends and family. And perhaps we might even find some of his colleagues from the police department that might be willing to write letters in support. But we would try to show the judge that this was an aberrational behavior, and he deserves a chance to redeem himself and go on and be a productive citizen. That's what we would try to do. And it would be an expensive proposition, because I need those psychosexual, I need the psychological battery on him, and I need to spend some time going to the people that are going to write the letters to make sure we know what they're going to say, and they don't make their way to the court until we see what they've said. And you know, this is not a $2,500 case here.
Right. And with what you're saying, I get that you're offering your services pro bono, but these other things, when you start calling in third party services, they're not free. The psychosexual is hundreds, if not in the low thousands of dollars. Where does that money come from?
Well, theoretically, it would come from the PD's office. Since he has no income, the case is currently assigned to the PD's office, and they are allowed some funding within reason if they can justify why this is necessary. And with this case, I think it would be considered extraordinary litigation because of the high profile nature, and we might get funding from the state. But again, it's a little unusual that these 4-3 felonies would merit the type of attention that he's gotten. But on the defense side, we didn't have any control of that. This was a choice made by the district attorney here. And these are the cards we're dealt. And if I'm a part of the team, I'm going to do everything I can to get this man the best outcome possible.
And circle back around. So sometimes higher numbers mean worse, and sometimes lower numbers mean worse. 4th is low as far as severity in this case?
That would be correct. If you move from the misdemeanor level to a felony, the lowest felony we have is a 4-3 felony. And the basic sentence for a 4-3 felony is 18 months. In the case of child solicitation, if you show up at a meeting, it elevates it one level, which would be a third degree, which would give him an exposure of 3 years versus 18 months. And then the other two charges are 4-3 felonies. But right now, they have not enhanced the child solicitation, because I think they're in a conundrum trying to figure out if he actually showed up for a meeting pursuant to the solicitation. They've got to be able to show that he did show up at a meeting. He did show up at her apartment, but there's no indication that he texted and arranged that meeting and that there was a solicitation for sex. They're going to have trouble if they try to do that, because I'm going to say, hey, sorry, you know, he didn't show up for a meeting. He was already there.
I see. Gotcha. Anything else before we move on to the final section?
Oh, I guess we've covered it. We got a lot to go through here. I'm running out of time.
Very good. We've combined three articles for this segment: a news release from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, otherwise known as NACDL, says that 24 criminal justice organizations, impacted peoples, think tanks, academics, activists, and reform leaders from across the ideological spectrum have united and formed a coalition to end the trial penalty. The trial penalty refers to the substantial and coercive difference between the sentence and a plea offer prior to trial versus the much greater sentence a defendant often receives after that. Would you please expand on that?
Well, according to the news release, those who choose to go to trial and are convicted often face sentences that are on average 3 times the plea offer and sometimes measured in decades.
The news release states that coercive and punitive effects of the trial penalty are so pervasive that they have virtually eliminated our constitutional right to a trial. In fact, 97%, over 97% of cases ending in a conviction never go to trial. Why is that such a bad thing?
Well, the NACDL statement says there are a number of issues reverberating through our legal system, including the waiver of numerous constitutional freedoms and rights, overcriminalization, loss of public oversight, and racial injustice. The coalition aims to restore the right to trial, helping right those wrongs to ensure a fair, rational, and humane criminal legal system.
If you'll allow me to read a quote, over the last half century, we have surrendered the framers' vision of a system of public jury trials to an assembly line of pleas coerced by threats of severe sentences, an assembly line that has generated mass incarceration, wrongful convictions, racial injustice, and law enforcement misconduct beyond the scrutiny of judges and juries. This was attributed to Martin Sabelli, who is the NACDL, National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, immediate past president and co-founder of the coalition. Tell us about the coalition.
Well, according to the news release, the coalition spans the ideological, political, and professional spectrum, and it will breathe life into the criminal legal community by identifying and dismantling the laws, policies, and practices that have undermined the vision of the framers. 40 years of coercive plea bargain is enough. It is time to restore the balance that protects liberty and freedom, end of quote.
We just completed a segment on plea bargaining where you defended the process. Let me read another quote. Rodney Roberts, an exoneree and reentry coach at Innocent Project, stated, "When I was arrested and charged for a crime I didn't commit, I was told that if I went to trial, I would probably lose and be sentenced to life in prison. Feeling powerless, I accepted a plea so that I would have the chance to see my loved ones again. Little did I know that I would end up spending 18 years in custody, both in prison and civil confinement, before DNA would prove my innocence." Can you please admit that this process is all kinds of effed up?
I can admit that the process is misused. But according to the NACDL, the pressure put on people to accept pleas is so overwhelming. Many people claim they would never, ever plead guilty to a crime they didn't commit. This man said he thought the same thing until, quote, "my life was hanging in the balance." But just because there are problems with the current system, that does not mean it should be scrapped in its entirety.
I'll share another story with you. One of my first roommates while I was gone had been sentenced to life. He claimed innocence. The prosecution offered a 3-year plea deal, 3 years for something attributed to murder, Larry. And he didn't take it because he says he's innocent and takes it to trial, and the jury finds him guilty, and he gets sentenced to life, and he died in prison, which is, if they only offered a 3-year deal, that it seems like they had pretty scant evidence. It seems.
That would likely be the case, yes.
There's another example from the NPR story. Robert Rose made one of the most important decisions of his life in 1995. Rose was on trial in New York for grabbing a gun away from his mother's boyfriend, then shooting and killing the man. Deep into the case, prosecutors offered him a plea deal. He followed advice from his lawyer and continued with the trial, with the homicide trial. Rose said, "In the end, I was sentenced to 25 to life instead of the 3 to 9 that I was offered." Rose remembered recently in an interview from his home in New York, "And I guess my not wanting to take a plea frustrated the judge as well as the prosecutor, and as a result, I was punished for, exercising my right to go to trial." How do you justify that one there, Mr. Larry?
Well, I can't justify the abuse of the process. I can say that the plea offer that he had dangled before him would have been preferable to the actual outcome after the trial in Mr. Rose's case. I tend to agree with Cully Simpson, who is a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative-leaning organization. Simpson said the system works pretty well as it is. He went on to say that, quote, "the fact that many cases result in guilty plea it's not a problem, because in many cases, and I've been a criminal defense attorney, the person is guilty and they're taking advantage of a plea deal that subjects them to less time. So I don't think there's a real trial penalty, he says. I think it's a privilege. And that's the end of the quote.
This is hopeless, really. Rose was punished for going to trial. He spent about three times longer in prison for going to trial rather than taking the plea. What do you say about this and the fact that prosecutors stack charges to induce a plea?
Well, I say we need to fix the system. I keep saying that. It's got problems, but we are in an adversarial system, and theoretically it's a plea bargaining system because the prosecution gains the certainty of a conviction, and you gain the certainty of an outcome that's not at the whims of the court. It is a managed outcome, and it benefits both if it's done correctly.
The leverage is all wrong, Larry. They're dangling all of your freedom in your face for you to walk away scarred, bloodied, and bruised. It's not really... I get the plea bargain, like the bargain side of it, but if you walk off the car lot after you've negotiated with the car dealer, you don't end up feeling like you just got... Well... All right, anywho. I don't think the system can be fixed. As Clark Nelly, Senior Vice President for the Legal Studies at the Cato Institute, explained, it's no accident that more than half of the Bill of Rights is devoted to the subject of criminal jury trials. The founders' decision to put citizen participation at the heart of the administration of criminal justice is unmistakable, and our decision to replace that process with one of plea-driven mass adjudication has led to countless false convictions, swept untold amounts of police and prosecutorial misconduct under the rug, and thoroughly undermined the morale and political legitimacy of the America's criminal justice system.
Everything that Clark said is correct, but this is an issue that we should be able to unite on in terms of fixing it. This coalition is a good thing. The coalition plans to further partner with impacted people and their families, community leaders, and criminal justice legal system stakeholders and local organizers to ensure everyone has a seat at the table in the effort to restore justice to our legal system. Remember, we're the ones who made the laws that said the judges can give you more time for not accepting responsibility. We can unmake that law. We're the ones who are in the driver's seat, just like we refuse to oversee police conduct. They work for us. We can fix this if we have the will to do that.
Larry, I see this as being something that maybe you could get this group or this group or this group, all these different kind of think tank kind of groups. But when it would actually come down to changing laws, I don't think that the public would get on board. Some criminal, whatever, jury trial hungry kind of prosecutor is going to get up and say that this is going to unleash an untold tidal wave of crime and blah, blah, blah. And these people obviously have been accused of something and they're guilty. Otherwise, we wouldn't accuse them. And then the public feels all fear-mongered and they're going to say, no, 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 we need to keep it exactly the way it is.
You could be right. And again, that's a shortcoming of we the people. Remember, we were blessed or we were endowed or whatever with the system where we get to determine our destiny. We can determine that we don't want to have a system where everybody is coerced into admitting guilt. We can stop this and we can make the process be what it was intended to be. The prosecution can operate fairly if they're forced to. They can be prohibited from stacking charges. I remember a guy that ran for president in 2016 said that he would seek prosecution of the maximum number of charges, the highest offense, and he instructed his prosecutors to do that through his attorney general. The people voted for that candidate, remember?
I do recall.
Well, we've got a chance coming up next year that we can vote again, and that candidate may be running as the nominee for one of the major political parties. And if you vote for that again, do not be surprised if the status quo doesn't change.
We can't even agree that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Well, I agree with that. And I even said that everybody, including the police officers, were innocent.
Well, I know you, but you're, well, I mean, to say it lightly, you're an anomaly. And I agree with you that you are innocent until proven guilty. But I think that by far and large, the mass number of the population, the public in general, at large, does not understand that concept, nor would agree with it.
That's a real tragedy, because I thought, I didn't realize schooling had changed. And that was one of the big things that I learned back in the 1800s, was that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Absolutely. Well, I hope this works. I think that everybody should get on board with this. End the Trial Penalty is an ideologically diverse coalition of criminal justice organizations and leaders committed to ending the trial penalty to ensure a fair, rational, and humane criminal legal system. And the coalition aims to eliminate the coercive elements of plea bargaining to restore our fundamental constitutional rights, including the right to a jury trial.
I agree with you. You should not get sentenced more harshly because you go to trial. But that's the way it's been for quite some time.
Well, Larry, as usual, I'm very happy that you are here. And I can't thank you enough for all that you do for the podcast.
I agree with you entirely. That is why I am here.
I would like to, I'll let you do it since you handle the snail mail subscribers. Did we get a new one there?
We did. We have Benjamin from Texas who joined us this week.
Fantastic. So he's going to be getting a snail mail transcript from FYP Education. Is that correct?
That is correct. And he subscribed for many months, and he renewed his subscription to the bi-monthly publication that an organization I'm affiliated with produces. And he's very fond of the work that both entities do.
Fantastic. Well, very good. Find all the show notes over at registrymatters.co or find the transcripts at fypeducation.org. Both are part of the same 501c3 organization. And you can find all the show notes over there that you want to find at registrymatters.co. And without anything else, Larry, I think that that will conclude this evening's extravaganza.
Thank you. I look forward to being back again soon.
I'll talk to you soon, Larry. Have a great night.
You've been listening to FYP.